Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Independent Bookstore Day. Very excited. It's August 29th, and we're kicking it off at noon with two British authors. I'm so excited to meet Alex Pavese, who is new, and thrilled to reconnect with Sophie Hanna, who's visited us several times. So let me introduce them briefly. Sophie is the New York Times bestselling author of numerous psychological thrillers, published in 51 countries, adapted for television. And interestingly, is on her, or will have out in a couple of weeks, her fourth, I hope that's right, Sophie, it is the fourth, right? Right, her fourth Hercule Poirot novel, which has been approved with by the Christie Estate and has had rave reviews. It's called The Killings in Kingfisher's Hill. And unfortunately, I can't show you a copy because it doesn't yet exist. With Sophie is Alex Pavese, who just, I'm fascinated with this whole book. Pavese's cerebral debut, it says, blends a mystery with an academic discussion of the mystery genre. Alex's debut tells the story of Grant McAllister, a mystery writer and mathematician who has mapped out a simple set of rules that govern crime fiction. Really? He got to this, I think, because although he's a former bookseller at Waterstones in Manchester and Peterborough, he's previously studied mathematics to PhD level and currently works as a software engineer in London. So this may be the most left brain, right brain author we have ever talked to. Would you say that's a fair description, Alex?
I mean, I have both sides of a brain, so I don't know. I think there's a historical overlap between mathematicians and certain art forms, so it's not new.
Well, you're new, so that's going to be exciting. And I know Sophie's a big fan of your work, but Sophie, let's talk a bit about The Killings in Kingfisher's Hill, and actually you might give us a little background and how you came to do this with the Christie Estate.
Yes, well, it came about by a complete sort of coincidence of timing. My literary agent was in a meeting at HarperCollins, and the meeting was nothing to do with me and nothing to do with Agatha Christie. He was just there to talk about a completely different author and book. But while he was there, he remembered that Agatha Christie was published by HarperCollins, and he remembered that I was a big Agatha Christie fan. And so he just blurted out in the middle of this meeting that was supposed to be about something altogether different. He just said, hey, you guys publish Agatha Christie and she's dead. So why don't you get my client, Sophie Hanna, to write new Christie brand novels? And he said all this without first running it by me. Like, I knew nothing about this suggestion. He just made it sort of off the cuff. And HarperCollins said, no, the family would never want anything like that to happen. And then by complete coincidence, the very next day, HarperCollins had a meeting with the Christie family, just one of their regular meetings about Agatha's backlist and the publishing. And at that meeting, Matthew Pritchard, Agatha's grandson, said to HarperCollins, this is going to surprise you after everything we've said all these years, but we have started to think that now might be the time for a continuation novel of some kind. And the HarperCollins editor said, this is a huge coincidence. I had an agent in my office only yesterday who thinks he might have the perfect writer. So literally that chance of timing was what made it all happen.
Isn't it interesting how often timing is crucial to steps in a career? Something you can't even plan for, but just somehow magically comes to pass.
Yeah, just very weird. And then, you know, we had a meeting and we got on very well and we all kind of agreed about what a new Poirot novel should look like. And here we are four books later, and it's been amazing. And for me, it's had the sort of great side effect that when I agreed to write the first Poirot novel, I knew that I was agreeing to write a Poirot novel, obviously, but what I didn't quite foresee was that I would kind of become effectively a sort of Agatha Christie missionary. I mean, certainly until COVID struck, I was traveling all over the world, you know, preaching about how wonderful Agatha Christie is, which was fantastic. So it's been amazing. So Kingfisher Hill is the fourth one, and it starts with Poirot and his sidekick for the purposes of my books, whose name is Inspector Edward Catchpole, they are on their way to the Kingfisher Hill estate, where they've been summoned by a man called Richard Devonport, and he has summoned them because his fiancée is about to be hanged for a murder, the murder of his brother, in fact, and he is absolutely convinced that she is innocent and wants Poirot to help out. So that's why Poirot and Catchpole are going to Kingfisher Hill. But while they're on their way there, they're on a luxury passenger coach from London to Kingfisher Hill, and on the coach, there is a woman behaving very strangely who eventually leaps up out of her seat and says, "If I sit in that seat for any longer, I will be murdered," which obviously attracts Poirot's interest. And that's what starts off the whole story.
So you have a couple of classic things there. You're going to have a large country house, which figures into many Christies. I also think it's important, Sophie, don't you think, and Alex, to remember that when you're writing in the 1930s, there was still a death penalty. You know, we've gotten sort of used to the fact that people are no longer hanged or otherwise executed. But, you know, with Christie, there was always that definite, when the murderer was caught, you know, it was going to be, as a rule, off to the hangman, put on the black cap, you know, barring any appeal, that was going to, so the stakes were higher, I think. But also, do you think that the ending is more satisfying when you know that the murder is going to be brought to justice in a dramatic and final way?
I think it depends why you read crime fiction. So for me, I mean, I'm fanatically opposed to the death penalty in any and all situations. So I'm not a fan of the death penalty. And for me, the satisfaction of the end of a crime novel is solving the mystery. That's what it's all about for me. It's that, you know, I've desperately wanted to know the answer, and at the end, I get the answer. And that's what matters to me. That's the closure I need. And if I've got that answer, then in an ideal world, I would like nobody to be hanged. But obviously in a crime novel set in 1931, that's not always a possibility.
There's been a real Christie sort of resurgence this year. I'm not entirely clear why. And the Christie that so many books have been modeled on is And Then There Were None, which, as you know, published under earlier titles. And I find that really interesting in a variety of forms. And Alex, I think that And Then There Were None has been mentioned in connection with your book.
Yeah, that's right. I have a whole chapter, which is kind of a, so there are many stories within the story in The Eighth Detective, and one of the stories within the story is an explicit sort of reference to And Then There Were None. But it imagines two people who live next door to the island, or kind of next door, but with a sea between, however you describe that. And they see that something's happened on this island, and you know, there's a broken window and a door blowing open in the breeze. So they go to investigate, and it follows them as they walk around the island, where something that clearly resembles the plot of And Then There Were None has unfolded. So they're there to discover all the dead bodies and try and work backwards and find out what's gone on there.
So how would you describe your book in the way that Sophie just mentioned her own?
So it's a novel that is about an author of crime short stories. His name is Grant McAllister. And in the 1930s, he was working as a professor of mathematics. And he came up with a system that allowed him to kind of work out what he thought was all the kind of important variations on the murder mystery format, in the vein of Agatha Christie, I suppose. And then he wrote seven stories in a little collection to illustrate each of his ideas. And then the novel picks up with him 30 years later. He's now living as a recluse on a Mediterranean island. And we follow an editor called Julia, who travels to the island. She works for a publishing company that's interested in reprinting his stories. So she goes to the island where he lives, and together the two of them talk through each of the stories. So it has the stories within the story, and then it has them discussing them. And she starts to notice some things don't quite add up about the stories, and she starts to wonder if maybe there's a link between those and some unsolved murder that happened in London in 1940. And it becomes a kind of battle of wits between author and editor as they work through his collection.
Wow. Well, I have so many questions, but I'm going to defer to Sophie, who's already said she has loads of questions.
One question I would love to ask Alex, and you may not be able to answer this because it could be that your answer would involve spoilers, but maybe it wouldn't. But the when I finished it, the thing that I think I got everything and made sense of it all. But the question I couldn't answer was, why is it called Eight Detectives? And I then went through each of the short stories and the true bits, counting any character in the book who could reasonably be thought of as a detective, and the number I came up with was not eight. And so I was like, why is it called Eight Detectives?
Yeah, well, that is an interesting question. I will tell you, there are seven stories that Grant wrote.
Yeah.
And then there's the framing story that ties them all together. So there are eight stories, which in a sentence is the reason it's called Eight Detectives. You rightly point out that some of them could be argued to have more than one detective. Some could be argued to have no detectives.
Yeah.
I guess I left that as a puzzle for the reader to work out who are the eight detectives. I've produced lists and come up with eight. And sometimes it's been different lists, different names on the list, sorry. So essentially it's because there are eight detective stories. Whether or not there are exactly eight detectives or whether there are more than eight detectives is up for debate. And so actually...
So there are eight detective stories, so it works. That works. But I think that I couldn't get it down to eight actual detectives. In particular, there's one story where there were two detectives and I couldn't eliminate either of them. So I had to conclude that that was a story with two detectives in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it comes down to how you're defining detective, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them are not police detectives, so they're in a more informal role.
I have to say that I actually thought that possibly the reader, i.e. me, when I was reading it, was supposed to be the eighth detective. Is that a plausible concept?
Yes, it's plausible. I mean, there is some ambiguity here that I can't really go into because it would spoil the end. So originally there were going to be eight stories, and the eight stories were going to be the eight detectives. Then I cut one of them because I didn't think it was working, but I didn't change the title to Seven Detectives because I didn't think it sounded quite right. Yeah. So obviously that's been interpreted as meaning that Julia in the framing story is the eighth detective. So the US title, the eighth detective, the UK title is Eight Detectives. Julia has kind of become the honorary eighth detective, but originally there were eight detective stories within the larger story. So yeah, there's not a definitive answer. I'm being a bit cheeky with the reader there, I suppose.
Okay. So now another question. Now let me see if I can answer. Yeah, I think I can ask this without any spoiling. So my understanding was that at the end, you give us everything we need so that we can form a conclusion rather than, like, I feel as though the book doesn't tell us the answer, but it gives us everything we need so that we know the answer. Now, would you agree with that analysis? At the end, I felt that I had to kind of, with some murder mysteries or, you know, detective stories, you get to the end and you go, okay, now I know because the book told me. Whereas with yours, I felt like, okay, now I really think I know because I can put it together myself. Is that what you were aiming for?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I'm a huge David Lynch fan, and I remember the first time I saw the film Mulholland Drive at the cinema.
Yeah.
And I came out and I kind of thought I understood most of it. And I went home and I looked on the internet. This was in the early days of the internet, I guess. And I found someone who had written up an explanation of the entire film. And it just sort of blew my mind to have this whole new layer of meaning. Right. So, yeah, I mean, there is some ambiguity to the ending, and you could theorize about maybe certain aspects of it are could be interpreted in different ways. Yeah, so that was intentional. That's something I really enjoy in a book, as long as it's, I mean, I don't like an ending that's too ambiguous. I think you need a, need some impact. Yeah, sure. So, but a little touch of ambiguity I quite like.
Yeah.
Do
you have a favorite or favorites of the individual stories?
I do. I mean, it's changed over the time I was writing and then editing. I mean, I quite like the shorter ones now, just because they were easier to work on when I had to go through them so many times during the editing process, I'm sure you'll know. So now I like the first one and I like the last one. So that's right. The one. First one has two people in Spain and their mutual friend has been murdered. And then the last one is set in a kind of boarding house and it has sort of slightly American noir feel to it. And it's got a guy going around. He finds a dead body on his bed and is searching for what that means. Coincidentally, those are two of the shorter ones, which I've grown less. I don't know if you feel this way, but once you've read your own work sort of 25 times, it gets harder to read. Do you find that?
Totally. Yeah. And then I can't really. And also it's the last thing you want to do at the point when you need to read it one last time to make sure it's all okay. That's when you least want to see it ever again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I write these kind of mysteries, my process is very iterative. I don't know if you're the same, but like I do have to just read over and over again and spot things that just don't work or don't make sense.
Yeah.
Is that the same with you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and one of the things I loved about your book is that, like, I love the cerebral puzzle quality to it. Like, when I started reading it, I wasn't just, like, reading it in the way that I read most books. I was reading it thinking, okay, I need to pay attention. I can't remember how soon I realized this, but fairly soon, like, a few paragraphs in, I was like, okay, stuff is going on. I need to be on good form to notice all the things. And all the way through it, that was part of the tension of it, was I kept thinking, I know I'm not spotting all the things. There are things that I'm not spotting. I can just feel them, but I can't spot them. So that I really love that. Because I think actually, you know, one thing I love about Agatha Christie and that kind of golden age style of crime novel is, there is a cerebral puzzle in there, and I really love that. And it doesn't mean I don't care about people and psychology and relationships and like all of that I do care about, but I actually love the puzzle mystery aspect of crime fiction. And I love it in a kind of structural way. I think if there's that kind of structure of a kind of elegant puzzle, it just does make it so much more satisfying.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think Agatha Christie's probably the master of that, right? I think, I'm really curious, when you took on the role of writing the Poirot continuations, did you kind of study how her books are structured? Did you go through and look at how she kind of puts those puzzles together?
I reread, so when I knew I was going to be doing it, I reread all of her Poirot novels again. I'd already read all of them about 3 or 4 times anyway, because I reread all her books every 10 years or so. But reading them, knowing I was going to be writing one, was a whole different ball game. So I read them, but I didn't get too analytical about it. I read them and I kind of took in, I think, in almost more of an intuitive way, the kind of things she did. And I also knew them so well anyway, because even before I wrote Poirot novels, all my contemporary crime novels that I wrote were so influenced by Agatha Christie. And even though they're very different from her style tonally and in terms of the atmosphere, the structure and the storytelling tools that I would use were always very Christie-ish. So like, for example, I would always, even in a contemporary psychological thriller, I always started with a really outlandish puzzle that would make the reader think, what on earth could be going on? Like, I can't even begin to speculate. And that's something that Agatha did so well. She very rarely started with a kind of ordinary mystery, like here's a dead body, who killed the dead body. She'd often start with something so weird or impossible seeming that the reader thinks, well, I literally can't think of any explanation for that. And then you're hooked because you have to read on, because you know there's going to be an explanation, but you kind of think, how the hell is she going to get out of this? And so you have to read on. And so I was kind of doing that and being what I thought of as Agatha-ish, but in contemporary novels, long before I started writing Poirot novels.
Hmm.
Are you or were you a big Agatha fan? Was she part of the inspiration for Eight Detectives?
I am, yeah. I always have been. I mean, I can't compete with you. I've not read all of them, actually. I've read about 30, I think, which is less than half, although it's a huge amount. Yeah, I mean, I've sort of been taking them out of the library for my whole life and reading them.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan. Yeah, I same as you. I really like the puzzle aspect. I think that's something that really crime fiction and probably only that kind of, I think probably only crime fiction can get you that kind of cerebral pleasure. I don't know ever any other genre of literature where you'd get that from, really.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, there's that, but there's also the fact that on a human level in our day-to-day lives, puzzle and the desire to solve puzzles is in fact our main motivation in life, because we don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know who we can trust. We don't know whether we're going to get that job we applied for. So we're constantly at the mercy of puzzles we can't solve in real life. And there's no promise that we ever will get the answer. So detective fiction is so satisfying because it says, here's a genre that understands how frustrating it is to be desperate to know and not be able to know, but we're going to give you the added treat of giving you the answer at the end, so it's all going to be okay. And I think that's why it's so popular, basically.
Yeah. I don't know if you're a fan of G.K. Chesterton. He was the kind of the detective writer that I first got into, really.
I've never read him. Do you think, would I like him? Yeah. Is he puzzling?
Yeah. So it's just interesting, yeah, because he had a sort of very philosophical approach to the detective story. And I think there's some quote about him about the detective being the philosopher of the city or something, because he, you know, walks through the city and sees human imprints everywhere. So, like, sort of buildings that have been built by people, and everyone's story is kind of imprinted in the architecture, and the detective is someone who can read that, I guess, was his idea. So, yeah.
I'm going to read him. I'm definitely
going to. Yeah, I highly recommend his Father Brown short stories.
Right. I'll download them to my electronic device as soon as possible. So, when you set out to write Eight Detectives, what was sort of like, was the main thing for you the way in which, because it's very clever, I'm not going to give away anything, but it's very clever the way structurally it comes together. Was your ambition in writing it, was it more that kind of elegant structure, or was it more the plot and characters, like the overarching plot?
I think for this book it was mainly about structure. I've always really liked books that have kind of stories within the story and sort of unusual structures. I don't know if you're familiar with, there's a book called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller, which, by Italo Calvino, which, if I remember it correctly, it's about someone trying to read a book. And they find the first chapter and then they get to the second chapter and it's been printed wrong. So they try and track it down and then they get a different first chapter. And it's just a series of different first chapters with this story of someone trying to get hold of the book that's gone missing, interwoven between these chapters. So that was a huge influence on me. I read it quite a long time ago, but I've always just really been interested in those kind of novels that have a slightly unusual non-linear structure.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite novels is The French Lieutenant's Woman, which I won't spoil anything about, but that has some kind of unusual narrative tricks in it. So I've always loved that, and I really wanted to do a detective story that had that kind of playfulness with structure. So that was the starting point, yeah. Then when it came to actually writing the sort of component parts, I could indulge myself in terms of dreaming up weird characters and strange locations and stuff.
And so are you writing your second novel now, or have you written it, or?
I am, yeah. It's due in a month, so it's nearing completion.
Is it like for people who love Eight Detectives, when they read the second one, are they going to think, oh yeah, this seems like the kind of novel that would follow on from that, or is it very different?
So I suppose what it has in common is it's a kind of slight reinvention of the classic detective story, I suppose. And it's kind of an unusual crime novel. But in every other respect, it's completely different. It's set in the modern day, has a pretty much a linear story. I mean, no one's read it yet, so I don't know
how. So you can't reveal any more about it?
No, okay. No. What are you working on now?
Why don't I know the answer to that? Oh, it's because I'm I'm not actually writing anything right now. So I finished Killings at Kingfisher Hill, and then I've been doing a lot of work since I finished that on, I run a coaching program for writers, an online coaching program for writers called Dream Author, which I launched last year, and it just took off more than I could have anticipated. So I now have many writers who are in that program. So I've been mainly helping them via the Dream Author program. And I created it really because I just started to notice that almost every writer I met had some kind of depressing or worrying narrative about their own writing and writing career. Mm-hmm. So like whether I was talking to a top 10 bestseller who'd been published for many years very successfully, or someone who was just starting out, whoever I was talking to, they would tell me a tale of woe about why they weren't successful and why things weren't going well for them. And I could hear that so many of the issues that they thought were just the facts of the case were just things they were inventing in their brains that weren't actually real, like people deciding they weren't successful when in fact they completely were successful. So just things like that. So I thought, I'm going to create this coaching program for writers to deal with, to help people deal with all the psychological and emotional drama that comes with either being a writer or wanting to be a writer. So I've been doing that and not writing books this year, but I'm just about to start my 11th novel in my Simon and Charlie series. So my contemporary novels, some of them are standalones, but 10 of them are in a series featuring a sort of detective duo called Simon Waterhouse and Charlie Zaylor. And I've had a brilliant idea for a Simon and Charlie novel. I've had it for like 5 years. And I just kind of never felt ready to do it. You know, it's like the idea was so good that I just didn't want to touch it. But that's what I'm doing next. I've decided it's ridiculous to put off this brilliant idea because it's too brilliant. Like, I kind of think it's so brilliant, what if I mess it up? But that's what I mean by writers inventing mind drama. That was me inventing mind drama. So I just thought, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to tackle it and I'm not going to mess it up. So that's the one I'm about to start.
Bravo, I should say. Pat is over here with a couple of questions from viewers. So why don't we take those and then we can go back.
Let's do it.
Viewers who are very interested and want to know both writers' research processes and also what are they doing during this COVID period, which I think Sophie has just touched on.
She has indeed, right. So often it's a process question, but in this case, particularly, they wanted to know about research. So either of you want to address how you go about preparing to write a novel?
Well, I mean, I'll talk about the research. The research for my Poirot novels is research that I've of a kind that I've never had to do before. So with my contemporary novels, if I'm, you know, if there's anything I need to know, like I make a plan of the whole story, identify the gaps in my knowledge that I need to fill, and then go and talk to people. And, you know, there was one novel I wrote where I needed to know what it was like to be a sundial maker, because my protagonist was someone who made sundials. So I went and spent 2 days with a sundial maker, which was actually amazing. But with my Poirot novels, the main research I have to do, Brewster, shush, that's my dog noise in the background. The main research I need to do is working out whether certain things existed in 1931. It's amazing how, like, when you write a contemporary novel, you don't need to worry about that because everything exists that exists. And so it's all straightforward. But when I'm writing a Poirot novel, I constantly find myself thinking, hang on, did people drink Harvey's Bristol Cream in 1931? Or was it only invented in the 40s? And, you know, how long ago was it that every house had a telephone? And were there lifts and elevators in hotels? And questions like that. So a lot of my research for Poirot is Googling, did X, Y, or Z exist in 1931? And then usually, thankfully, the answer is yes. But I have had to, my second Poirot novel, Closed Casket, the original plot involved somebody talking about having a kidney transplant. And I happen to have a friend who's a kidney specialist, a medic. And I said to him, you know, when was the first kidney transplant? And he said, 1952. I was like, oh. And I tried to cheat. I was like, surely there was some early, very basic. He was like, no. Not in 1930, there were no kidney transplants. So I had to change my plot as a result of that.
So, Alex, how about you?
I mean, I don't have much method, to be honest. I'd never imagined myself writing a book set in the past. I just kind of fell into that. So I was making up as I went along in terms of how to approach the research. I sort of just tried to... I didn't, you know, when I needed to know something, I'd do the same as Sophie and just Google it, which is fantastic. I don't know how I'd have done it before Google. The harder thing for me was sort of getting the attitudes of the period correct. So I came up with a great way to cheat for that, which is to sort of find a novel that was contemporary for that time and just kind of sort of make sure that my story would make sense in the context of that novel. So, for example, the first story in The Eighth Detective set in Spain in 1930 and features a man and a woman who are an ex-couple. And what I had in mind when I was writing that is the book The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, which is set, I think, in a similar time period in Spain. So I kind of tried to make my characters act slightly similar to his characters, assuming that his is accurate to the time period. I came up with a variety of different tricks to try and solve the research problem, but it's not something I had any methodical way to go about. The biggest problem for me in terms of when to set the book was actually, as we mentioned, there's a reference to And Then There Were None, which was published a bit later than I'd have liked it to be. So I think it was published in 1939. So I had to shift some things in my book to 1940 to fit with that, where I'd have rather had them at the start of the 30s. But I got there in the end.
It was certainly clear from listening to both our authors that no better preparation for writing books is there than actually reading books. I think that is clear in your answers. So Alex, you know, this is sort of a bookseller question, but as you did work for, you know, as a bookseller, did you have that dream going into it that when pesky customers were not in front of you, you know, you could do that kind of Dickensian thing, sit on a stool and open a great book and not be bothered by anybody? And how long did it take for that to dissipate? Because with me, it was like a day.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember if I had that dream. I certainly dreamt of having like erudite conversations with customers about stuff. The reality was not quite so romantic.
Why were you book selling? Was it, you know, a job? I mean, the basic reason you take a job, i.e. for a paycheck when you were not otherwise employed, or did you do it out of some desire to be thinking it would enhance your potential career as an author?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's because I grew up in a part of the country where there's not huge job opportunities, and retail was sort of the only option. And I thought a bookshop would be the nicest retail environment to work in, which I think is probably true. Well, one of them certainly. And then I'd got a foot in the door at the company, so I continued when I went to university to do my master's. I changed to a different branch then, but was in the same company, Waterstones.
I've been in the Waterstones in Manchester more than once, yeah, with Val McDermott when she lived in Manchester. And there was a crime festival, a small one, and organized in Manchester. Sophie, you might remember. We all got snowed in. Do you know, it was one of those.
Dead on Deansgate.
It was dead on Deansgate. Thank you. And it was one of those freak snowstorms that hit. Now, picture me as an American thinking that things ought to work. And what I discovered was when this storm hit, that the trains couldn't run because the rails either contracted or expanded, and you couldn't drive on the motorway because there wasn't enough clearing equipment. The airports were closed down. So basically we spent 3 days in Val's house, building fires and drinking whatever there was. And I remember how amazed I was, because I grew up in Chicago where something like that was just, shrunk it off. So, yeah. But anyway, it was a flagship store for sure, in Manchester. So yeah, would be great. I wanted to ask you a question about sleuths, because, you know, you brought up Father Brown, and Father Brown had a profession where he had an income. And so if he wanted to go off and do some detecting, he didn't have to worry about the financial consequences of shutting down a business or, you know, moving away from whatever job he was doing. He was still employed while he was investigating. Poirot is a professional investigator. Julia is an editor, so she's an amateur sleuth, so to speak. You know, she has a job, and that's why. Do you think about that when you think about, you know, what characters that you want to write are going to be a detective? How are they going to maintain any kind of lifestyle? What kind of income can they derive from this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, it just depends on the story I want to tell. So in my Simon and Charlie book, Simon and Charlie are both police officers, so they have, as it were, official access to, you know, they can turn up at people's houses and demand to be told things. And obviously when I'm writing Poirot novels, Poirot is a professional detective, so he's not an amateur sleuth, he's a professional private detective. Catchpole, who's the narrator that I've created to work with Poirot, he's a Scotland Yard inspector. So, but I've got an idea for another series of crime novels, which I will definitely write at some point, though I don't know when, because at the moment I'm too busy to do anything new in addition to what I'm already doing. But in my new idea, there are two detectives, and they're both very much not professional detectives. And so I think, you know, it's the same as with writing a contemporary novel and writing a historical novel. Whatever the story needs, you just kind of work out a way to do that thing as well as you can. And I think there's advantages to both. There's advantages to the, you know, if your detective is a police officer who can just compel people to cooperate, that's obviously an advantage. But I think, you know, certainly as a reader, I love reading amateur sleuth detective novels, because I love the idea, and I guess there's a certain element of wish fulfillment. I love the idea that you can be not at all a professional investigator, and yet you can still get the answer before the professionals. That's a very satisfying idea for someone like me, who always secretly wants to solve mysteries in real life.
Anything for, I asked the question, Alex, in part because there is a very large subgenre of crime in the United States, which are called cozies, which is not what generally is meant Baiacozzi and UK terminology. And these are all people who like own a bakery or have a chocolate shop or own a bookstore or run a needlework or a knitting thing and all. And, you know, and yet somehow they have a leisure to go off and, you know, abandon whatever their normal profession is and spend time sleuthing. And it's a difficult problem to solve in those mysteries. So you wind up with the reader just suspending disbelief and thinking, or, you know, maybe somebody comes along out of the kitchen at the bakery and takes over while the baker is off detecting.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of writing, coming up with an amateur detective and sort of justifying that scenario is pretty hard. So yeah, I mean, income is just one of the issues. You know, there's also questions of how they get access to the crime scene and how they can command any authority when they're questioning people and things like that. Just for no particular strong reason, I've never had any real desire to write about police officers doing their jobs. So I think, you know, anything I write like that would probably mainly involve amateur detectives. So yeah, I mean, I'm aware of the problems that need to be solved. The Eighth Detective, one of the stories features a amateur detective who is a teacher, and the way I sort of gave her authority over the situation is there's a murder in a restaurant and the police are prevented from coming because there's sort of a huge fire in a department store down the street. So they need someone who's got a sort of position of social responsibility to look after the crime scene while waiting for the police. So that ends up being this teacher, and she ends up becoming a bit of a detective herself. So yeah, I mean, there are solutions if you can kind of think outside the box, I guess. But it's not an easy problem.
We had Lord Peter, we had Mr. Campion, you know, we had a number of, you know, people with private incomes and plenty of leisure time and a lot of curiosity. But that's harder to find in contemporary fiction, I think. So that's why I asked. That's why I've always liked Father Brown, Rabbi Winter, for example, a similar detective, if you know those books. Let's wind up by talking for a moment about, you know, since you're both British authors, but you're both being published in the United States, we can see, Alex, looking at your book, that the red one is the American edition and the white one is the British edition. How much input do either of you have in, you know, publishers obviously have the right to, you know, dictate titles and covers if they want to, but one always thinks it's a collaborative sort of thing. So did you have much input with either publisher?
I mean, they asked me if I liked it, and I said yes both times. I don't know what would happen if I said no.
I bet they loved collaborating with you. That's exactly the collaboration every publisher dreams of.
Yeah, probably. So I mean, the change to the title, I guess, was more impactful for me. So actually, I think we first discussed that because Peter Swanson brought out a book called Eight Perfect Murders back in March, I think, which weirdly in the UK is published as Rules for Perfect Murders. So there was no kind of naming collision in the UK. So that's why, well, that's at least why we started talking about changing the title in the US. I mean, they showed me three different covers in the US and they were all fantastic, actually. I really liked all of them. That was great. And then the UK, they showed me this one and I thought it was perfect. So yeah, I had
to. Are they different covers? Which is the one? I've only seen one with, it's kind of white or cream with like dots, like circles on it.
Yeah, that's the UK edition.
Here. Oh, that's you're right. I haven't seen that one at all. Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, they are quite different, and Sophie's, yours are too. Your UK cover is the same brilliant red, and your American cover has a black background, you know, quite different. I'm always you know, because your books, for example, are translated into, 50-some languages, and therefore, you know, you've got at least 50 publishers who are taking their own, you know, using their own data and using their own intuition to come up with how your book should be packaged. I often wonder how authors feel when they get, you know, an array of books that all look different, but it's the same book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just, like, it was clear early on with my very first crime novel, which in the UK and the US is called Little Face. In France, the French publishers of Little Face called it, well, obviously it was in French, but the literal translation of the French title was No Lullabies for Fanny. And I was quite happy for every territory to call the book whatever they wanted to, whatever worked in their language. Lots of languages said Little Face just wouldn't work in it. Totally fine. But I was slightly perturbed by No Lullabies for Fanny because there wasn't a character called Fanny in the book. So I did raise that tentatively. And my French publisher said, don't worry, we thought of that. So we put a character in who's called Fanny. I was like, oh, well, that's okay. So no, that was all a bit strange. But no, generally I'm quite happy for, like, any territory where English is not the main language, I pretty much let them get on with it because I'm not the expert. In the UK and the US, I am consulted about covers and titles, and I always, you know, very honestly say what I think. Usually I just say, yeah, I love it and that's fine. But when I have had a serious issue with either a cover or a title, and I've said so, my publishers are always very good about that. I've never been made to have a cover or title that I didn't like. And whenever I've said, you know, I really don't like that because X, Y, and Z, they always do change it. And so we always end up with something that everybody likes. My one regret, well, it's not actually a regret, because I don't bother regretting things. I always think, where I look back and think I made the wrong decision, I always think that was actually really useful to make the wrong decision, because next time I'll make a better one. But the wrong decision I made was when my book set in Arizona, Did You See Melody? That was what it was called in the UK. Did You See Melody with a question mark? And my American publisher thought that was a bit too unusual, and so asked if we could change the title. So I said, yeah, I'm happy to hear other suggestions. And it ended up being called Keep Her Safe, which I have no objection to, but the publisher did say to me, look, if you want to, we will agree to call it Did You See Melody, but we think Keep Her Safe is a better title for our market. And I decided, actually, I'd rather they, if they're sure, I'd rather they had their way because they're the experts. But I think if I could turn back the clock, I would have said, yes, let's call it Did You See Melody? Because the more I think about it, the more I feel strongly that Did You See Melody is a really interesting and unusual and strong title. And Keep Her Safe is kind of an okay title, but it's nothing special. So that's the one, that's like the one that got away. But that's the exception. In fact, all my other American titles that are different from the UK titles, I love the American ones equally. And I'm kind of glad that each of those books got a chance to have those two different names. So for example, my latest psychological thriller in the UK, it's called Haven't They Grown, that was my title. That's a title I love. But in America, it's called Perfect Little Children. And I also love that title. And when I think of the book as being called that, it kind of gives it a slightly different identity, which I quite like. I quite like the fact that the book has these two. I don't know whether you feel that, Alex, because your title is different, but it's also a bit the same, isn't it? It's not that different from the UK version.
Yeah. It doesn't cause me any pain. I mean, I would find it slightly easier if they were the same. I never know what to say when I'm writing on Twitter or something, you know, any kind of promotion. I think throughout the course of this discussion, I've said Eight Detectives and The Eighth Detective interchangeably. It's quite hard to keep track, to be honest.
Well, it is for me too, to be honest, because yeah, you know, both editions. And I think about Stuart Turton, who I had here last summer, and his English title is The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, and the American publisher decided to call it The Seven and a Half Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, which they think is partly responsible for its success, but I still haven't worked out who the half death applies to. So, I find it a little bit odd, but numbers are coming into titles quite often recently, which is another, like, as you mentioned, Peter Swanson, you know, 8 Perfect Murders. So I have no idea. Pat, did you have any more questions, or are you just waiting to sign off over there?
No, we did have a question from Susan Thompson Nix, who wanted to know if they had any choice with their audiobook narrator.
Oh, okay. We do have a reader who's asking, did you have a choice in who narrates your audiobooks, either of you?
Yeah, I always get sent a few clips of voices, and I put them in an order of preference. But then I don't then check up and see whether the voice I like best is the eventual voice. And I must admit, I've never really thought that much about the audiobook until, for my Poirot novels, I've had the same narrator for all 4, an English actor called Julian Rind Tutt, or it might be pronounced Rind Tutt. And I get so many emails from people saying, your audiobooks are amazing because of him. He's so brilliant. So I'm now very attached to him and kind of thinking, I hope he's willing to do all my Poirot novels forever, because he's clearly brilliant, because people who used to buy the hardback are now buying the audiobook because of him. So I think he's got to be an extra special audiobook narrator. So I'm very fond of him. But no, I just like go for, I always, if I'm choosing from female voices, because a lot of my narrators are women, so most of my audiobooks are read by women, I always choose the one who just sounds like an ordinary person talking. And I tend to veer away from anyone who sounds too performancy or actory.
Alex, have you had any input? I assume there is an audiobook, but I didn't ask.
There is an audiobook, yeah. It's read by a British actress called Amelia Fox, who's very good. I wasn't given any input, but I'm not sure this is an entirely representative instance, because obviously things this year are a bit strange. So Amelia, I think, had the ability to record it at her home while the whole country was fully locked down. And I assume there was a remote director somehow interacting with her. So that shortened the list, I guess. And I'm not sure the normal processes were followed.
Well, I think Sophie's touched on the fact that if you have a series, it is best to have the same voice if the voice is successful. I know my husband listened to all the Harry Potter books while he was out, you know, running or something, and was addicted to the narrator. It would have been hard to change that person in midstream. So we're coming up on the hour, and I'd like to thank both of you. This has been a wonderful discussion. It's really been a pleasure to meet you, Alex, and to reconnect with Sophie. So is this your first meeting, the two of you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, it's been brilliant. Really exciting. Yeah.
Dazzling all around. So let me just say goodbye to the Facebook audience. Thank you all for joining us. And this is Independent Bookstore Day, so we have some wonderful giveaways for you if you come by to pick up something. And at 2:00, we have another program with 4 authors chasing a gold watch that's cursed down from 1733 to maybe a century and a half later. Anyway, please join us. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.